Welcome to another special episode of Oncology on the Go, hosted by Daniel C. McFarland. In this episode, Dr. McFarland sat down with Xiomara Rocha-Cadman to discuss wellness and burnout in oncology. The pair touched on wellness versus well-being, the emotional and psychological demands of oncology, and the importance of support systems and mentorship.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and listening today. We have a great topic. We're going to be talking to Dr. Rocha-Cadman, who has been a mentor and a friend over many years. And what we're going to talk about is wellness. So we hear so much about wellness, staying well, preventing burnout. That seems to be somewhat of a full-time job. We can probably all agree it's essential for ourselves to not be burnt out and to take care of our wellness for ourselves and for our patients. One thing that sometimes gets a little lost in this translation is that actually research around this area is very new. You know, it's historically, this is an area that's been cut off from discussion and from investigating. But now that we've kind of accepted the issue that there is such a thing as professional wellness and burnout, et cetera, the attention that it gets, I think we could all agree, actually is beneficial. There are many ways to kind of improve ourselves and kind of get better at what we're doing. But the messaging to care for oneself can feel overwhelming and a little moralistic at times. It's sort of like asking the clinician who's already burnt out to do more, which really doesn't make much sense. And so the other part of that kind of burnout situation is that it's a worker-workplace mismatch. With the research that we have actually shows that the more effective treatments actually address the workplace issues, you know, the workflow and things like that, because it all depends on why the person might be getting burnt out in the first place. So we're gonna touch today upon a really key area where I think psycho-oncology has a lot to offer in terms of wellness for clinicians, for oncologists, and that is interpersonal communication with patients and families. So there's value in training and providing tools and concepts about what to say and when to say it. It must be difficult to change communication patterns without understanding what's going on beneath the surface. You know, communication traps and pitfalls don't just happen randomly. There are reasons why we get stuck or why certain patients are going to challenge us more. So this really comes down to reflection. So one must reflect on it to get to know your patterns and personal pitfall areas. And so being vulnerable with honest reflection really illuminates these patterns and can lead to real change. Much easier said than done. Xiomara has conducted many groups and facilitated training in this area. So that's why I wanted to invite her to kind of talk about this with us. I'm sure we're going to have a very rich conversation. Xiomara, I want to start off with kind of an open-ended question. And that is, from your perspective, how should we, as professionals, how should we think about wellness?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you, Dan. It's not because being a psychiatrist, we always focus on the people's reaction. I always care for how our colleagues do or how they're doing. I think one of the things that I will say that I still say that if I'm not doing psycho-oncology, the second most important thing that I'll be doing will be opening a practice only to focus on our own colleagues. So I generally care for them. Through the years, I've learned a lot from them as well. So the piece of being a psycho-oncologist or CL psychiatrist, it's, I think, one of the most fundamental aspects of that specialty is to be able to be a good liaison. And being a good liaison doesn't only mean delivering information about the patient or collaborating with the team. It's also getting to know the other side of cancer, the oncologists and what they do, and appreciate their work. We're very critical at times, and we always see what we want to see, right? And we focus on what we do and how our job is so important as a psycho-oncologist, because we have that space that we bring to our patients, and we feel very intimate with our patients. But one thing that I will also emphasize is, like, we are the consultants, and our medical team are the ones that bring our patients to us. So having said that, it's very important to define what we mean by wellness. We often use the term wellness and well-being interchangeably, but they are not the same. So I work in the wellness, I've been part of the wellness committee but right now I'm the chair of the well-being committee. So well-being refers to a broader sense of how we are doing emotionally, physically, psychologically, and even spiritually. It reflects our overall quality of life and sense of meaning, purpose, and satisfaction. So that's how we are doing. Wellness, if we think of wellness, is basically the road that takes us to well-being, right? Mm-hmm. So on the other hand, it's the active process of cultivating habits, behaviors, and, you know, and environments that support that well-being. In other words, wellness is something we practice, while well-being is often the outcome. I still hear like, oh, well, I'm sending this patient to wellness. I mean, this colleague to wellness. And I'm like, no, that's well-being. So many people think of wellness as simply exercising regularly, eating healthy foods, or getting enough sleep. I am a runner, so that's part of my wellness. Running makes me feel better, so therefore it impacts my well-being, right? And while these are certainly important components, wellness is much more comprehensive. It encompasses how we manage stress, how we maintain relationships, how we connect our values, and engage in a meaningful work, and care for ourselves during periods of challenge and uncertainty. In cancer, we encounter so many challenges, and we deal with patients with a lot of uncertainty. Our colleagues, oncologists, live in uncertainty as well, you know, when they're treating patients. So wellness is not just a destination, you know, that we achieve once and for all. It is an ongoing process of adaptation and self-awareness throughout our lives and careers. In medicine, in particular in oncology, wellness takes an additional complexity. The demands of caring for patients with serious illness requires not only clinical expertise, but also emotional presence, resilience, and compassion.
I love that. Yeah.
So wellness does not mean the absence of stress, grief, or difficult emotions. Rather, it involves developing the capacity to recognize these experiences, respond to them thoughtfully, and sustain ourselves while continuing to provide that excellent care. It is about, I think, it's if I see it like creating the condition that allows to remain engaged, effective, and connected to the meaningful work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, ultimately, it's about alignment, right? So it's between our values, our actions, our relationships, and how we can care, how we care for ourselves as well. It's like, well, the words that we give to the caregivers, right? Like, you got to take care of yourself so that you can take care of somebody else.
That's right. You know, you're making me think in your previous role, you know, where I got to know you a little bit more, we would, as trainees would come in, and these are psychiatry fellows, there was a trajectory over the year that they would spend, right? Where it would sort of be like, you know, you're getting used to it the first, you know, 3-4 months. And then as the winter would come on, typically, things would start to feel heavy, and it might be bringing up issues. Hopefully there was a resolution, you know, by the time the spring comes, and you sort of have gained a sense of mastery. You were so intimately involved in that. What I see from my perspective is that, you know, I did training in oncology, so I know that typically in an oncology 3-year medical oncology program, you're going to get a month of palliative care. So we don't necessarily kind of facilitate the same sort of self-reflection that trainees in psychiatry have, or that you've obviously been a part of. It's beautiful what you said about wellness is not the absence of having feeling frustrated, you know, having whatever the emotion might be. You know, it's about coming back, dealing with it, engaging with it, et cetera. It was a great sort of overview of wellness and well-being. How would you incorporate with wellness and well-being in mind, would you say something like that's sort of inversely related to burnout? How do you see the relationship altogether? Because is it kind of on a spectrum, or are they sort of more like classification?
Yeah, so I will say that, you know, make me think what you're saying right now. Make me think about my role in the well-being committee. When we get referrals from our colleagues that are already showing signs of, you know, like some behavioral, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe somebody like coping with burnout, like drinking or doing drugs. I mean, thank goodness we don't get those, referrals, but it's been known, right?
Of course.
Because we are not so aware while we are working and we put in, and we kind of like putting in boxes, right? Like I'm dealing with this grief and this loss. And so then it gets to the point that we can only, you know, we're humans. We can only deal with so much suffering and be able to, you know, provide the care we provide to our patients. I feel that if we will be more proactive before, you know, doing the formation of the wellness in our career, like incorporating all the things that we should and be aware, our well-being will be more, will be better, right? So I think it is tempting to think of wellness and burnout as simple opposite ends of the same spectrum, particularly because burnout has become such a prominent topic, like well-being now, wellness, right, in popular cultures. Many public discussions of burnout focus on generalized workplace stress. So productivity pressures, yeah, we know that, our work-life balance challenges. While those issues are certainly relevant, they often fail to capture the unique emotional and existential demands of oncology. Yeah, we have so many responsibilities. We train as physicians. We used to train for 100 and something hours. Now we do 80 hours, right? Or even less. So it's like people going in, like the army, right? You are trained for the worst case scenario. But we undermine that, those issues of the existential and emotional demands in oncology and in medicine in general. So oncology clinicians routinely form deep relationships with patients and families, right? While simultaneously confronting serious illness, uncertainty, suffering, and death. I think this experience creates stresses that are qualitatively different from those encountered in many other professions. So yes, we have all these other responsibilities, you know, and all the demands at work. But that piece, I think it's in my opinion, as a psychologist, is very important. And complicating matters further, many of these stresses are not always fully recognized, right? Even by the clinicians themselves. So way of continuing to function and provide compassionate care, we often develop psychological defenses that allow us to manage difficult emotions and remain effective in the moment. So while these adaptations can be protective, they may also make it harder to acknowledge the cumulative impact that repeated exposure to loss, grief, and emotional intensity has on our own well-being. And as a result, this stress can go unrecognized until manifesting as burnout without exhaustion, disengagement, or diminished sense of meaning in a workday.
Yeah, I love the distinction that you were making between sort of generalized professional burnout and kind of what we do in oncology and the unique stressors there, because, you know, the air we breathe is, am I going to survive? Yes or no? How am I going to be impacted? And you're sort of doing that day in and day out with patients. One reason I think that's such a key distinction is because oftentimes when you read the burnout literature, they sort of group the treatment modalities into, let's sort of calm things down and take a break and relax, you know, and sort of that might be, heck, that could be yoga. That could be a lot of things, right? That are sort of just decreasing stress fundamentally, you know, and then therefore providing a better way to start thinking about moving forward versus modalities that actually help to engage in the patient care because, you know, there's not really a great option to disengage, you know, it doesn't look good. And it's very hard to do that. And actually you sort of mentioned that it's one of those things that actually provides a tremendous amount of meaning for oncologists. And so it's sort of like engaging is the antithesis, is the antidote to sort of burnout. I always think of it like that. It's maybe a good way of just thinking, as you mentioned, it's hard to measure this in ourselves, but we can measure in a way, are we being engaged or not? I have to say, the thing is that, you know, oncologists, again, get very little training in how to do this, Zio, and I think we all know that. What do we do about that issue? I see so many ways that it would be so helpful to further that, you know, to further the self-reflection.
So, Daniel, you're making me think about something else too. So, when I first came to City of Hope from Sloan Kettering, I met Dr. Wiseman. He just recently retired from here. I met him, I think because they Bill knew that I was already coming here. So, they wanted me to go and provide some care to a family member. And they said, oh, CEO is going to City of Hope. He works at City of Hope. And I came and introduced myself and I said, I'm just coming as a colleague. I know that you guys are going through a rough time, but I want to be here as a colleague, and be happy to see your family member. So I went in and then later on, I came out and we exchanged cards and I said, well, I might be coming to City of Hope. Months later, I came to City of Hope and I looked for him. He never forgot me. And he said, what you did for me in the moment, it was just a human, like humanistic approach. It was just like another colleague being there for me. And it wasn't a doctor and doctor, it was just you. And I did what I thought it was the right thing, but what I felt, right? But then after that, Dr. Wiseman used to ask me, CEO, can we meet once in a while to chat? And I was like, wow, I mean, what an honor. This guy's he's been on the field, for so many years. And he brought with him your one of the publications that you did, Dan, about the oncologist as a first therapist or something.
Oh yeah, of course.
He brought it, and we were talking. So, in my office, he would come to my office. I wouldn't even have to go to his office. He would come to my office, and we started talking about this paper. And I said to him, he was as a resident when I was a fellow, and he said, he's just now like writing, he's an oncologist and da, 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 da. So we came up with this idea of maybe even teaching or bringing awareness to our new oncologist. He said, and he said something like to me, as I am getting older, I'm thinking of meeting central psychotherapy. I'm thinking of my legacy work. And I was just laughing because, of course, he had read about the Breitbart and Meeting Center. And he said, how can I teach my new fellows? How can I make him create their legacy? And also be feel for those patients, feel the loss. So this went on for, I don't know how many weeks. We used to meet like every 2 weeks for an hour just to chat. And this guy was already thinking about the impact and also as he was exiting the career, right? And thinking, how can we create mentorship for our oncologists? So he ended up creating a fellowship, a mentorship for the fellows program. And but what came out of this, it was, I said to him, well, when I was at Sloan Kettering, I created this process in place, space for our psycho-oncologist. I thought we were in need, and I heard that they also needed it. Through the GME, I asked, I proposed this, and they said, "Oh, sounds great. We'll do it." And we did it differently. I mean, we tried different ways. We first of all, we started like four different people, kind of like guiding the group that were not psychologists. I was the only one. There was a psychologist, and then there was a palliative care, two palliative care doctors. And we had, and this is during COVID, so we had, they would join us through Zoom. And at the beginning, it was great. They would talk about their loss, and they were talking about COVID, the impact of COVID. And then slowly, they stopped coming. Following year, we tried to do it. And then I think it went on for 4 years. And at the beginning, these fellows will come in. And then I will be the only one waiting for the phones. So there's a resistance, I think, or there was no need. They didn't find any need. They felt that giving that time during the day, and it was once a month, they would rather be eating good food or walking around, talking to friends, or finishing the charts that they were needing. So it's a culture, right? That it's something to think about. I just wanted to bring that up.
Having an experience where this is kind of collective, it's normalized, it's part of the culture. It's something you do is it has to be key. And you made me think that I think there was kind of a resurgence of interest in this area after COVID with everything everyone was experiencing. And that may have kind of rescinded over time. It's delicate because these are kind of closed groups in a way. And it's hard having someone who might not understand, come in and sort of do this. I've often thought the best way to kind of create excitement around this, and is it sort of from the top down, like leadership? Is it just a sort of habitual thing? Because I think what you're saying is like it can't just be someone's in crisis, and we're gonna, every time they're in crisis, like that's not the idea. The idea has to be that, this is something. I mean, you and I know because we sit down, we discuss patients, we sort of have rounds, and it might come up like, oh, this patient, this. Something was going on that was very interesting with this patient in my interaction with them, and that's a very different way of talking about patients to say, hey, this patient, this situation made me feel a little unsafe or a little vulnerable, and I don't know exactly what that relates to, but it's something I need to be aware of. I've often thought too, Zio, that like we, this these balance groups are something that I don't know why we're not taking more advantage of them. Because one of the things that I love about the balance group is that, there's a very clear like agenda when you do it. People come, there's usually like two cases that are discussed, and then everyone contributes. And so you sort of learn from other people. And then what I think actually, if you've ever participated in one of these, where it gets really interesting is that, let's say I bring a patient and I'm talking, I say, hey, this was a difficult situation for whatever reason. And I give all the information, and then people might ask me some questions, and then I step out of it. So I'm not there anymore. And then the folks that I was just talking to, my colleagues, are talking about my situation. And there's something so rich about that, where you sort of see, you see this, it's almost like, a third person. That's sort of mindfulness. That's sort of like, stepping outside of yourself. Because when we get stressed out by these situations, we often feel like we can't see another way around, and so anything that kind of broadens that horizon or makes you think of a different thing, that's really what supervision does, I think, where I'm stuck, help me with this. And someone who's not seeing the patient necessarily says, well, maybe there's this going on. Maybe there's some other thing. It's a very important thing, balance groups. And the other thing is peer support. Peer support is becoming more of a more formalized kind of modality. If you've looked into that
I am also part of the peer support.
yeah, you are. Okay.
I
Yeah.
think it has to do with peers. Yeah, so that's also a good thing. I mean, there's more. I think there are more resources now that we had back in the days. But again, the peer support becomes like a crisis moment, right? Somebody was like threatened by someone, and they are having some reaction to that, so they refer to peer support. So I don't know how it is in many institutions, but it's good to have that peer that can provide the space and make you feel validated and have somebody to normalize those fears or whatever reaction that you're having, and also feel heard. Sometimes, how many times do you walk by a colleague and you say, "Hey, how are you?" And the person, you see that they want to say something. And then you're like, "Oh, by the way," you go on with your own stories because you want to be heard too. So I think having that peer-to-peer, it's very important.
Yeah, that's a great point. Everyone's so busy, they just kind of, and it's hard to make time. You got to make time for it. I guess that's part of wellness,
Yeah,
right?
but it's also craving that connection, right? And now it's like everything is on Teams. I mean, COVID is done, it's gone. We still get the Teams and the Zoom, but when we see each other and you're happy to see or connect, it's a great thing.
I was going to say too that there's a whole literature about doctors or lawyers or other professionals. These things are not new. These are very old. I remember in some writing projects, like just learning about the old literature from hundreds of years ago, talking about, what would happen when a physician essentially became burnt out. The other thing that's really key, I know you know about this, Zio, is like the what happens, say, when doctors treat each other, and that we actually, it's sort of the VIP syndrome. You know, you can get worse care because we don't ask the sensitive questions. And so it's just funny because I think that, you know, if we're really going by the data tell us that actually, you know, rates of alcoholism, drug use, burnout, depression, all these things are higher in us. You know, it's just we don't necessarily talk about it like that. You know, maybe we should. Maybe we should be more sensitive to the fact that these things are pretty rampant. They're pretty highly relevant, even though, you know, we are providing wellness, hopefully, for our patients. But we can't let it take too much of a toll on ourselves. And it, you know, if we look at the data, strictly looking at the data, it does. It does.
And we saw that a lot on COVID, right? A lot of people.
Yeah. Well, the other part of it is just getting mental health care. You know, that there's, this whole sort of controversy about, you know, for the medical boards, you know, asking about mental health, and that, you know, that is very contentious, and that should just be a known thing, that it has actually been stopped in many states and everything, because
hospitals have changed those. My understanding is a lot of hospitals have changed the wording of that. You know,
Right.
but that's still the stigma of mental health, right? Well, screening period now.
Anything else that you think, maybe, let's say, like cancer centers themselves, like any idea on them helping to facilitate this process? Is that a can of worms?
No. I was wondering about psych oncology always being concerned with the well-being of oncology.
Yeah. It has been a longstanding, a longstanding interest of psycho-oncology, you know, the mental health of oncologists, right?
So it's great if you have, you know, at a cancer center, hopefully you have psycho-oncologists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not every center has it, but there's so many NCI designated institutions. Thinking about the ones that have it, I feel that this is a good place for psych-oncologists to play a role in the well-being of oncologists. And like I was saying before, I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Weissman. I used to sit down, and you used to sit down with Jimmy Holland. I always feel like, you know, learning from the older ones, you always have to have a mentor no matter what, even as you're
Yes.
80. I hope that when I turn 80, I still have a mentor. So I, again, like in psych-oncology, CL, the CL ward, the liaison piece, it's also not only the patient, it's also looking out. I always feel like when I'm walking in the hallways, I look out for my colleagues. And I used to do that at MSK. And I remember one time I was walking down the hallway, and I saw one of my colleagues. Her face had completely changed. And again, I didn't ask that question. I think I asked the same question I asked you.
Yeah.
I said, "Are you doing okay?" And she was like, "Yeah, why are you asking?" I said, "I don't know. I just feel that there's something more." And that was it. And she broke in tears. She had just came out of a room, and she knew that her patient was going to die. So what I hope that I would, you know, invite people, invite other mental health providers, not only thinking about ourselves and being introspective, it's also thinking about your brother and sister that are working in the same workforce. I think psych-oncology has always been concerned with well-being of oncologists because our field sits in the intersection of cancer care, emotional suffering, meaning, and human connection. So we see not only that what patients are experiencing medically, but we also see their fear and their grief, their uncertainty, and all the existential distress that they go through. But I think it becomes clear that oncologists are exposed to these same emotions that we are exposed. I mean, we provide that space for the patients to come and talk to us. They don't have that space.
Right.
You are, as an oncologist, you know, have so many patients to see on a day. How can you provide a space, right? Your space is provided to treatment and what to do next, and it's about the cure intent. But when they are carrying all these responsibilities of making difficult treatment decisions and holding hope and delivering bad news, trying to remain present for patients and family, it becomes very, very hard. Not intentionally. They don't want to do it, right? So but it's just because of the pace that they do, that they, you know, they work at. I think,
go ahead.
This matters because clinicians' well-being directly affects the quality of our presence when we are with our patients. And when oncologists are emotionally depleted and unsupported or unable to process that cumulative grief, it can affect communication, the empathy, and, you know, everything that we know about burnout, decision making. But also they can be seen as somebody detached, you know, by the other colleagues, like hospitalists, you know, can say, oh, well, this oncologist, like, I've been trying to reach out to them, they don't even care. Well, we're trying to do a goals of care discussion, and they don't even want to be present. So I think it's just not, I'm not saying justifying the oncologist's behavior or the perception that but it's also understanding and maybe being a little bit more like, okay, this is what I'm perceiving from this oncologist. And it's not a trend that we see from this particular person, but it's just something different. So be in tune with that and be more curious about, like, what are they going through? It might not even be a patient that they're going through a difficult, because that's part of the balance, right, in life. Balancing problems at home and providing the care that we want, it's another, you know, conversation, right? So that person might be going through a divorce, or that person might be going through their children dealing with drugs or being suicidal. I mean, I don't know. And on top of that, they come in and they have to put the uniform and they come in, you know, to see our patients. So they might seem a little bit disconnected from the team and from the patient, but maybe because they are like dealing with something bigger at home in their personal life. And that's something. So I always think it's like, be aware that oncologist that looks disconnected, that usually is not, or just be aware and be and reach out to that person as a colleague, as a friend.
Yeah, like you said, it can make a really big difference, the timing of those sort of personal contacts. And that's the thing, is that sometimes, you know, when someone looks a certain way, they're kind of giving you the vibe that don't talk to me, you know, and you're saying, you know, kind of go above and beyond to say, well, this doesn't fit the pattern. And, you know, perhaps I will talk to this person.
Dan, there's also the happy doctor, right? Remember, I don't know if you ever read people about the happy doctor, always happy and became suicidal, right? So just when somebody, you know, when somebody looks isolated, somebody looks disconnected, or doesn't look right, have those radars around you. And this goes for every colleague. It doesn't necessarily have to be a psych oncologist. It's just being aware of people suffering and signs that they might not fit that criteria. They just look off.
Yeah. You know, I really like what you said about mentorship and, you know, how, because it's really kind of striking, it's really common that people don't have those relationships, and those relationships are so meaningful for both parties, you know, and it's something that, like, especially as we get to like the middle of our careers, that can kind of fall off. But that's sort of the time when you still need it. You still need it, because stresses change, they're different. You know, the other thing I was thinking too, Zio, as you were talking, was about, you know, oncology care, it tends to kind of happen in these pods of, like, you've got the oncologist, the NP, the nurse, and you're also just seeing the same thing. I think, like, because to be honest with you, a lot of the support that I feel I've had over the years in caring for patients has been within my little pod, my little, you know, and man, when you have a pod that's like working really well, it's just great. You're like all sort of supporting each other. You're sort of like going through the same things. And you know, there's something about that awareness of, and hey, we had to deal with this situation and this situation. This was a tough day, or this was a good day, or celebrating those things. So those dynamics are really key. I think we don't pay enough attention to those interdisciplinary kind of relationships and how much support they really provide. You know, like for example, when the powers that be may just decide, oh, we're going to switch around all of these, your nurse and your NP and all of that. It's like maybe, not a great idea all the time because, we work in a team, we work in that way. So I want to just, ask you anything else you kind of want to address or say in this topic?
I thought I was reflecting earlier on my years of fellowship when I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering and how I transitioned from being a fellow to an attending. One thing that made me realize of the need that was out there, it wasn't only the reflection of my own experience. In psychiatry, you're trained to have those boundaries, right? Those flexible boundaries that you want to maintain that distance and different relationship. But when you go into psycho-oncology, all those boundaries, I used to tell my fellows, just put them up there on the exit door. You will need them eventually. But when you are doing the work of psychiatry in the oncological world, you become like Jimmy used to say, you become a servant to your, I mean, this sounds crazy, but this is how I feel it. You serve to your patient. You know, you are, there's a beautiful book that just came out in Wellbeing, and I bought it. It's called The Attending. We forget to be attending to. You know, attending doesn't mean, oh, I'm an attending doctor, but it's tending to your patient. And I think that's a beautiful thing, and it's such a meaningful work. But at the same time, the boundaries of how do you recognize giving so much to your patients, it's affecting your well-being, or, you know, so it's always being on check with what's going on. I feel that with the work that we do is so demanding and so draining. I sometimes I said I come as a little plump, you know, grape, and I come out as a, you know, that's one of those
As
raisins.
a raisin, I was gonna say, yeah. Wait, that's wine or no? As a raisin,
Yeah, why
there
maybe later.
you go.
But you know, even as you are when you are dealing with your own personal, you know, like, you know, right now I'm dealing with my own personal issues in oncology, not myself, but a family member. I feel at times that I'm drained by the demands as a caregiver. And when things go a little bit better at home, I come back and I just get, you know, re-energized by my patients. It's hard to explain. It's because my work is so meaningful, right? And I love what I do. I don't do anything differently except caring for other colleagues, right? But I just wanted to say that doing some compassion work on ourselves, like when we are feeling very drained and pulled in different directions, and having that compassion to come back and kind of like reconnect with your within yourself, with yourself, with your being, it's very important. I will not forget when I became an attending. When I was a resident at 12 months, you know, at 6 months of my training, I felt like I can deal with this. I'm dealing with this. I'm very resilient. And I was seeing some of my colleagues having a difficulty with through after the second month, after 3 months. And here I am at 6 months, I feel great. And I will never forget that in December, I had a patient that had been transferred to Cornell. And she came back to the hospital to MSK, and she said to me, you know, for Christmas, can you wear a red jacket or something like that? And I was rotating through Cornell. And I'm like, she said, just come back festive. And I remember that day, the next day was Christmas. No, it was something, it wasn't Christmas, it was getting closer. So I wore a red jacket and I came to see her. But between coming from Cornell, I had promised my kids that I was going to go pick up the Christmas tree. And I was living in New Rochelle at that time. So in my mind, I was thinking, how am I going to make it to buy this tree for my kids? That it's, they're my kids. They're my, there's the purpose of keeping me well balanced, you know, and coming to show up to this, for this woman. So I don't know how I did it, Dan, but I came and showed up for her. And then I rushed, and at 7 o'clock, I was picking up those, the tree for my kids. The following day, I stopped by and I went to look for her. And I remember that they said, I saw the bed was empty. And I was like, oh, she got discharged. That was my wishful thinking. She had passed away at 12 o'clock. And somebody said to me, came one of the nurses came and gave me a hug. And she said, no, she died. Well, and I remember that time that I had everything that I had so composed during the whole 6 months. It went out of the window. I went straight to the bathroom and I cry and cry and cry. And I thought, oh my God, this is a horrible pain. And I was just like grieving the 6 months of all my patients, which I kept in a paper. Every patient that I lost up to today, I have not missed something, but I have all, you know, a list of all my patients, their first name, that I have lost since I started my fellowship. I remember coming to later on. That day, I think I talked to one of my colleagues, Shruti, and I cried. And I have so much pain and grief. So when I started working as an attendant, 3 months into it, I was feeling the same thing. I used to feel this jaw pain and this, like, you know, like something in my throat. And I went to Bill Breitbart and I went to him and I said, how do you deal with this? I feel that it's just like brewing in my soul. And he said to me, Sio, by the time that the light starts flickering, it's a little bit too late. Before it starts doing, you know, going off, you need to know, you need to recognize the signs. I will never forget that. So every time I start feeling that, you know, the feeling here is like, oh my God, it's a little bit late.
So yeah.
Just be in tune and recognize that the accumulation of grief has an impact in your health and your well-being.
Yes.
And also recognize those little signs that starts coming, which we tend to ignore.
Yeah. No, I love what you said, because it's you set it up perfectly where, you know, this was not the vision of yourself that you had. You had this experience, and then you really learned that, you know, and you also, you learned that, I guess, one, you're human, and then two, you know, what the specific signs were that you kind of manifest in that. And, you know, I'll share one as well. So when I started as an attending, and I, you know, I'm like, look, I'm good. I trained and all this stuff. I got this. I met with Dr. Rocha Kadman. Like, I'm good, right? I was pretty busy at Memorial Kettering, and this funny behavior started that I did not recognize in myself, which was that I became, like, interacting with my patients, I noticed my use of humor was elevated. And I like to have fun, and I like to, you know, but I'm not like that. I'm not a comedian, you know, I'm not, you know, and I mean, it wasn't ridiculous. I mean, I don't think anyone, like, reported me for, you know, stand-up routines or something, but it was just a little bit, like, a little bit much. Like, I realized, like, why am I kind of laughing, or why am I kind of making jokes, or people are, you know, and I said, wow, same thing. I was like, it's a stress. It's my first time being attending. It's a lot to deal with. And that's what I started doing. And it was, you know, a lot of it was just being interested. Like, yeah, why, just kind of being open to, like, okay, I'm doing something a little bit differently. What might that mean? You know, did I suddenly just grow another funny bone or something? Or, you know, maybe more likely, I'm under a lot of stress, and this is kind of an interesting way that it kind of gets manifested out. And yeah, anyway, that was like my epiphany as I started in this business, too, that, you know, happened. So
you're doing something great right now, Dan. It is just bringing this to oncologists, your podcast, I think it's amazing.
Thank you.
I think the important thing is that compassion, having that compassion for our colleagues, our patients, we are compassionate to our patients. We're talking about the professional caregivers, always looking out for each other, because no institution, no government is going to look out for us, right?
Yeah.
So it is looking out for each other. And that's the best thing that can happen. We come into this field of medicine, and hopefully it's for the true calling, not because we're masochists and we want to have a long, many years of wasting your youth, you know, books and not sleeping, but also not because our parents told us that we should do that. But it's a true calling, and I don't think there's a better career in profession and medicine. So I really hope that we can always stick to each other, stick, you know, together and care for each other.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point too, is like, I think the answer to a lot of this is in the interaction with the patient. You know, it's not moving away from it. It's understanding it better and understanding yourself in that interaction. And so, you know, I think because that's you did that for me. Many others have done it as well. And it is truly something that, you know, when I started oncology training, I said, boy, my colleagues don't get this. And not like get it, like, you know, but they don't literally get it in their curriculum. And that is an issue. That is a real issue. I thank you so much. Thank you, Zio. And, you know, we'll talk again.
Yes. Yes. Take care then.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook at Cancer Network without the O, or on LinkedIn at Cancer Network.